Hello, I'm food writer and cookbook author Priya Krishna. Did you know that more than 750,000 New York City children are likely to miss two meals a day this summer? When class isn't in session, many children lose access to the free breakfast and lunch that is usually served in schools. The folks at Food Bank for New York City want you to know that unlike school, hunger doesn't take a break. Help them end hunger by providing meals to families and children in need. Visit foodbanknyc.org to learn how you can volunteer, spread the word, and more.
Hi, Bomb Squad. You're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb, and I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. Each week, we talk to the most inspiring women in and around the world of food. Let's thank today's sponsors, Le Cordon Bleu Culinary School and Traeger Grills. Speaking of Traeger, we'll be grilling and chilling with Traeger Grills ambassador Amanda Haas tonight at a special event in Sagaponack at Wolfer Estate Vineyard. Curious what's on the menu and who our other special guests are? I'll let you know during the break. Housekeeping time. We're headed to Portland, Maine for the next stop on the Radio Cherry Bomb Food for Thought Tour. We'll be there the evening of Monday, July 22nd for a special live episode of our show. Tickets are on sale right now at cherrybomb.com. Join us for the taping, the snacks, the networking, the special guests, and more. If you don't live in Portland, tell your friends who do. Thank you to Carrie Gold for supporting our tour. We love your butter and your cheese. I hope everyone's plastic-free July is going well. I'm doing pretty good at this point. Shopping at the farmer's market has definitely helped me cut down on single-use plastic. I bring my own canvas totes, some old Ziploc bags that I wash and reuse, yes, instead of throwing away, and those great Stasher silicone reusable bags. If you haven't checked out Stasher yet, we're obsessed. I've also started carrying a reusable spoon in my little makeup bag. And of course, I always have a reusable coffee cup. That is a non-negotiable in my life. Don't forget, Plastic Free July, hashtag Plastic Free July. Now to today's episode. We're airing a conversation from Jubilee 2018 between author Ruth Reichel and Chef Ruth Rogers of the River Cafe in London. These two game changers share more than a first name. They both care deeply about this industry and improving the lives of everyone who works in food. Hearing the two of them talk about how the River Cafe is run was totally inspiring. Joining them is special guest Sean Wynn Owen, head chef of the River Cafe. Enjoy their conversation.
Well, you're meant to sit there. No, you're sitting there. No. Please. Thank you. No, you sit there.
Okay, we have an addition because... Back in, while we were waiting, we started having a conversation that was so interesting about how the restaurant is run that we asked Sean Owens, who is Ruthie's partner, to join us. And I think it's particularly appropriate because this gorgeous book, and I'm wearing colors to celebrate, I mean, it's just the colors alone. And the rest, I mean, it's a wonderful book, but it begins with the most beautiful tribute to Ruthie's late partner, Rose. I mean, it's so moving. And you said that after she passed away, you took in new partners. So will you introduce Sean?
Yes. This is Sean Owen, and she's... the head chef at the River Cafe, and my partner. The loss of Rose is incalculable, and it was for all of us in a very small family. It was something that we were prepared for, but then, you know, how do we continue? And what we did was form a kind of group. It was four of us, two chefs and two managers, and we became, they were the Rose, you know, and very soon afterwards, someone approached us with the idea of doing another restaurant in his hotel, and I think it was very soon afterwards, and every meeting that we went to, they would think maybe I was going to be there, and there'd be five of us, you know, and so we went to meetings, and we formed this group, and it became really an incredible partnership and way of inclusiveness and working out. So that, and so Sean and I are here to do the book, and we're here to do Edible Schoolyard. It's again combining a kind of social involvement and a responsibility that we have for society, for values, for education, with the excitement of doing our recipes and the story of a restaurant.
You know, it's so interesting because let's go back a little bit to how you opened the restaurant in the first place. Yeah. Because it seems to me that it's such an example of how differently women do things than men. So you're not a chef. Rose wasn't a chef. You were women who like to cook. In some ways reminds me of what I did in Berkeley. I mean, a group of us who liked to cook opened a communal restaurant. And it was just, none of us were trained. We just loved food and liked to cook and wanted to feed people. But something happened to you, which did not happen to us. I mean, the Swallow lasted for 15 years, but we never really got famous or got big. You got very big and famous. I mean, The New Yorker in 1987 called you the best Italian restaurant in Europe.
That got us into a lot of trouble with the Italians.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think the person who wrote that forgot that Italy was part of Europe. You know? So we would have phone calls saying, are you really sure that you're better than this restaurant in Milan, Italian-wise?
Yeah. Well, you know, The New Yorker has a history of doing that. They did it with the Hunan restaurant in San Francisco in, like, 1970, where they called this little restaurant run by a former airline executive who was not a chef, but who was cooking the first really spicy food in San Francisco. They called it the best Chinese restaurant in the world.
In the world, yeah.
Which didn't go over very well
it's
with the
Chinese
magazine.
Either. It's a brilliant magazine.
But what I wanted to ask was, you know, it's one thing when you start out and you have 9 tables and your kids are there and they're all helping out and it's kind of a family affair. But the moment that's really hard for most of us, and I've experienced this some in my life, is what happens when you get bigger? Mm. And how did you handle that? I mean, how did you handle that evolution from, oh, our kids are here helping us make sandwiches, to Mick Jagger's on the phone wanting to come have a reservation?
Yeah. It's a very long story. We recently, the reason this is called River Cafe 30 is that we recently celebrated our 30th birthday. And at the party, my opening line was, there aren't very many women of my age who can celebrate their 30th birthday. So it is a 30-year-old story. And to shorten it, I would say that, first of all, Rose and I grew with the restaurant. And when people tell me that they're going to open a restaurant now, some of our chefs say, you know, I'm going to, you know, they look at, I'm going to leave you, Ruthie, and I'm going to start my own restaurant. And I think, you know, it is really hard. And we were very lucky because we had a beautiful site. We had a very, very restricted, the restrictions that we had actually, I think, helped us grow. So we weren't allowed to open to the public. We were only allowed to be open at lunchtime. And it was a very small space. And I think that we were, as you say, we were very, it was Rose and myself. We had, because we were only allowed to open to a very small group of people, we were restricted in the food we could cook. So we had a short menu. One of us would do sandwiches, one of us would do a pasta. We had a grill, we had a fryer, and we had 4 hot plates. But I think we had 2 things. One was we had ambition, and the other one was that we had control. And if we had, my husband is an architect, and his warehouses were where we started. And he very generously gave us, and we had his accountants helping us. And I know it doesn't sound very romantic, but even in the first day, if I had a coffee, I paid for the coffee. You know, friends came to lunch, I paid for lunch, usually I paid for lunch, but they came, you know. It was just a very rigorous. So I think that behind creativity and behind joy and behind passion for food, there has to be a rigor. And I think we had that from very early on. And then the stages that we had, as I said, we grew, one of my favorite, if I may, but one of my favorite pages in the book, I say not a recipe, is this diagram which actually shows how we grew. I don't know if you can see it. But basically it starts in 87 with, as Ruth said, six tables. And then we, in 94, is it 94? We grew and we had a proper kitchen. And then we had a kitchen and a bar. And then we had a fire in 2008 when the restaurant, you know, we could have either just painted it white and gone on, but we really invested it and had a private dining room. And so I don't know if that answers your question. It was a struggle. We almost closed 3 years after we opened because, you know, however careful we were, it was a very difficult to be small, to be cheap, and to be closed most of the time was a very hard, recipe. But we got through it. And I think, I mean, there are many reasons, you know. Rose and I were there every day. If we wanted to go to work, and I think that still is the case, if I want to go to work, then you hope that everybody who works with you will want to go to work. And, you know, Rose and I had no restaurant experience at all in other people's kitchens. But Rose had a little bit here in New York with the McNallys. And then we had people like, you know, Jamie Oliver. No, not Jamie, because he didn't have experience. But we had Theo Randall, who had a bit. We had Sam Clark, who had a bit. And then, you know, we had people like Sean and Joseph Trevelli and Danny Bowen. And the people that came in had really worked in other kitchens. And so we taught them, but they taught us. Does that, I don't know if that helps.
Still, I think learning to manage people is a really hard thing to do. And one of the things that really fascinates me, I mean, maybe I'm naive in this, but when we were talking earlier, the way that your restaurant runs, it seems to me, is very different than the way any restaurant in America that I know runs. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you've solved is the front of the house, back of the house dichotomy. So, Sean, can you talk a little bit about what happens in the morning when...
Yeah, so we, I mean, I don't know how many of you have been to the River Cafe, but we write the menu every single day, twice a day, for lunch and dinner, every day of the week, every, you know, 360 days a year. And so it means that you could actually eat in the restaurant every day if you want to. You know, in theory, you can eat every day without getting bored. But
you also said you also change lunch and dinner every day.
Yeah, we change it for lunch and dinner. So we do two menu changes every single day. And Rose and Ruth wanted, the original idea was if you went for dinner in someone's house, you wouldn't start cooking for that meal on a Monday if they were coming on a Friday. You'd probably start cooking in the Monday afternoon for dinner that evening. And so that's how we do it in the restaurant, but just for, you know, 200 people rather than 20 people, 10 people or something. And so everyone takes a part in preparing the meal, from the kitchen porters to the chefs to the waiters. So I'll sort of come into work and I'll look at the weather. And in London, it's usually raining, but if on the off chance you get like a sunny day, you might be like, oh, what do I fancy eating today? What have we got in the fridge? Just like you would do at home. So you're like, what have I got in the fridge? Who's working today? What's the level of the experience of the chefs? If we've got people that have worked there for a long time, we know they might want to be challenged, but younger chefs need to, you know, learn. So we've got lots of ability people. And so we kind of look at the team, who's working, what's the weather like, what do I fancy eating? Most of all, you know, kind of, the first thing I think, well, I probably, like most of you, when you wake up, what do I want to eat today? Then I can go to work and write it on a menu. So it's the most luxurious way to cook, that you can just cook what you want to eat and times 200 sort of thing. And then we just proportion out all the jobs. So waiters peel potatoes, kitchen porters prepare the fish, the chefs all do the butchery, and then we all cook together to get ready for lunch. The waiters don't cook. The waiters peel garlic, chop chilies, pick herbs, and then we all cook together. And at 12 o'clock, the waiters go and change and make sure the tables are all set. The chefs all get onto their sections that change every day. And then we all cook for lunch service. And then we sort of have our lunch, and then we write the menu for dinner, and then we do it all again. So we just...
But I'm just fascinated by this notion of waiters doing prep work, that you're all in it together. I mean, it's just... It's such a radical idea, compared to the way most American restaurants are run, where, you know, the kitchen does one thing and the front of the house does something completely different.
I mean, I worked in kitchens where the chefs and waiters would not get on previously, and you'd make food for the waiters that you just, no one cared about, because you'd be like, it's just for the waiters. And there was a kind of divide. But from when I started at the River Cafe, straight away you see that there's this, it's everyone. And I don't want to make it sound like it's some kind of, like, well, it's a serious workplace, but everyone gets on because we all sort of share the common goal, and, you know, everyone's in it together. It's a really unique way.
And for the customer, you know, the idea that a waiter isn't just repeating what the chef said, and tonight we have these specials, but they've actually been in there doing it. We're struggling so hard to figure out the tipping and how you equalize the pay between the front of the house and the back of the house. And it seems like such a reasonable way to think about this as a profession, you know, that everybody is in together.
But also, it also makes being a waiter at the River Cafe very interesting. And so you have waiters who actually, if they're not that interested in food, then they really find it boring to do that work in the morning. But we've had very few. Mostly what you get is very informed and engaged waiters who, as I said, if somebody eating there says, what's salsa verde? They just haven't memorized it because we've told them. They've prepped it. They knew they had. They'll come to the chef and say, are you doing salsa verde today? And then they'll tell the rest of the team, you know, get the parsley, get the capers, get the anchovies. So it makes for them. And also, I think one of the things we haven't brought into it is the fact of the architecture of the restaurant. So it's kind of a democratic restaurant. There aren't such called good tables or bad tables. The chefs are on view, which means, you know, that the kitchen has a certain kind of manners, you know, that you don't shout, that you keep it clean, that you move around. People, if you watch, I once said to a friend of mine, it's rather like who's a director, I said, it's rather theatrical. And he said, it's more like ballet, because you'll see the chefs moving around because they can't shout, because you might have a table 10 feet away. And I think it's the same thing with the waiters, that the waiters can find something they need in the fridge, or they need something, or they're involved. And so, and very definitely, you know, the receptionists, the kitchen porters, as Sean said, that we come in and everything we have is delivered whole sea bass, whole legs of lamb, whole turbot, whole beef. And so the preparation is very, also very shared.
I want to come work there.
Yeah.
You should.
Come, yeah.
We'll be right back after a quick break. Hi, Bomb Squad. I'm en route to Sagaponack for our special dinner with Traeger Grills and friends at Wolfer Estate Vineyard. I'm really excited to hang out with Chef Kia Damone, Chef Elizabeth Carmel, Pastry Chef Yossi Areffi, the always chic Joey Wolfer, and Traeger Grills ambassador Amanda Haas. The chefs will be cooking each course for the dinner on Traeger Grills, from the appetizer to dessert. Want to see what's on the menu? You can follow along on Instagram at Cherry Bomb. Thank you to the folks at Traeger Grills for supporting tonight's dinner and for supporting this show. If you're coming to tonight's dinner, I can't wait to see you. Don't forget, try it on a Traeger. Visit TraegerGrills.com.
Grab your notebooks, Bomb Squad. We're going back to school this summer with a brand new radio show, Cherry Bomb University. Each week, we'll be offering crash courses taught by your favorite members of the Bomb Squad to get you cooking, eating, and thinking like the smart cookie you are. Thank you to Le Cordon Bleu for making this series possible. You can learn more about Le Cordon Bleu at cordonbleu.edu. See you in class.
And now, back to Ruth and Ruth.
The other big problem we have in this country is, you know, the problem for women chefs is motherhood. And a few years ago here at Cherry Jubilee, there was a fascinating conversation between Gabrielle Hamilton and Suzanne Gowen. And they both said, we're terrible mothers, you know? I mean, because it's... How did you...
My stepson is sitting right there. He can say, am I a terrible mother?
He's gonna get
I think,
mad.
Actually, my youngest child was 4 when I opened the restaurant. And Rose had 4 children, older than mine, you know. And I would like to liken it. Whenever people say, is it hard for women, you know, being a chef? Is it hard for women cooking differently? I'd say, it's usually journalists who ask me, and I say, well, it's hard to be a journalist, isn't it? Isn't it hard to be a lawyer? Isn't it hard to be an architect? Isn't it hard to have children and work? And so I try and take being a chef not as a different profession than any other profession. And that's something that Sean and I, that's my job, is to make it so that when you work in the River Cafe, it's not you have to come in at 7 in the morning and, you know, turn on the oven, or you have to stay all hours, or you have to do... It's our job to make it possible for men and women to have children, to work, to have a life, and be a chef. And I think that myth of the idea of being a chef is an impossible job has to change, or we'll never get the right people to work for us. So I think in the River Cafe... Sean, who really runs it, could talk more. But we, you know, from the day that Rose and I started, we every chef has 2 days off. No chef works more than, what would you say, 5 or 6 shifts a week. We have women who have children who have chosen to do less. If you have a double, then you don't do the next morning. You know, we really try and make it as a place that you, and we have. And we're very professional. We're not a touchy-feely. We're too expensive to be like, oh, sorry, you know, we didn't finish the pasta sauce. It's a very rigorous job. Mm-hmm. Would you like to say? Because you're a mother. Sean is a mother now of 2 very young children. One of them is here.
Yeah. I brought my child to work today, which happens to be in New York, so that's very nice. But I think we also, it's really hard. It's also important to make sure that, you know, I've been a chef for, like, 25 years, and I've seen how coming up the ladder, how it would have appeared to be so difficult to have kids and be a chef. And now, as I'm a head chef, I feel like I have to be really supportive to other women who have kids. And you kind of often think, well, just because you didn't, well, not at the River Cafe, but haven't had that on your way up, it doesn't mean you shouldn't see past that when you're actually there. And we've had a few women in the kitchen who've just gone off to have babies, and actually really proudly I feel like we've actually really looked after them appropriately and pay them through it. You know, like I feel like you can feel kind of respectful to us as a kitchen that we can actually do, we're fortunate enough that we can afford to do it, but also there's no option for it if you want women to be chefs. And a lot of women have to give up because working at night is very hard because you don't have childcare at night if you're a single mother. I mean, it is a hard job. But I feel proud to think that we actually can facilitate that at the CAF. We make an effort to
I mean, it is a huge problem. I mean, not just in this... I mean, yeah. when I was the editor of Gourmet and young editors would come and say to me, I'm pregnant, and I would say, are you coming back to work? And I always said yes. And my classic response was, and now you're going to understand what true guilt is.
Yeah.
Because no matter where you are, you feel like you should be somewhere else, and trying to make a workplace where if a kid gets sick or there's no school and they can bring them, I mean, it's really a problem that we as a society have to deal with, and deal with soon, because women shouldn't have to go through the, oh my God, the school just called, I have to leave work and I'm in the middle of something else. I mean, we really need to figure out how to make the workplace everywhere.
Mm. But you want quality. You want also want... I mean, I think running a kitchen, you want the quality of life for, you know, for the men and the women. So you want the chefs and all the employees to have... Not just to be so tunnel vision that all they're doing is working. So they have to have the good hours so that they can have a home life and they can read about cooking and they can eat out and they can cook at home and they can have a dialogue with food that isn't just being in the professional kitchen, which when you're working the hours, you lose your passion. So the reason you go into a pretty badly paid job to begin with is because you're passionate about food, but then you can't sustain it because you're working too long hours. So we really pride ourselves on the fact that people can have a home life as well, across the board. So you love coming to work, you love going home. There's no shame in saying, actually, I want to go home. I'm looking forward to cooking something tonight at home for my friends. You know, that is the best thing if you can have that balance. You know, then you can work in the job for a very long time.
We also are very, I think we are very engaged with the people who work for us. You know, so it's quite a small team. We employ probably altogether about 90 people, 100 people. But in the kitchen, it's a lot. But they've stayed a long time, and we know them. And we are at, one of the stories that I like very much was a very, very young chef a few months ago cut her finger, and she didn't want to go home. She wanted to work. And then I heard that Sean said to her, "I'm sending you home, and I'm making you go home." And she said, "But why?" And because Sean said, "Well, because one day you're going to be a head chef, and I want you to send the person home." You know? And I thought, that's what you call about investing in the people who work with you.
And have you read Bill Buford's book, Heat?
Yeah.
I mean, there's that amazing moment where he cuts his finger and it's like, suck it up.
Yeah.
Okay, let's dial this back. How did you get interested in food in the first place?
Well, I married an Italian, I suppose. That helped. And his mother was a great cook. But I always was interested in food. If as a child. Apparently my grandmother was, who died before I knew her, but the story goes in my family, she's Hungarian, and she came to see her first grandson, and my mother was there and said, "Do you want to see the baby?" She said, "No, let's eat first." So I think I probably did grow up in a food house where food was, you know, the table was a lot about talk, but there was always good food. I grew up in upstate New York. I think we learned about seasonality not through sophistication, but I just knew that if we were having corn, we'd buy it for lunch, we'd buy it in the morning. If we were having it at night, we'd buy it in the afternoon. And there was a sense of food, the importance of food. So I think with my friends, I always loved to cook. When I moved to London, I loved to cook. And then I got involved with an Italian family. My mother-in-law was an incredible cook, Merle's great-grandmother and Zad's grandmother. And she cooked. She was an Italian who came from Florence during the war, and she learned to cook with what she had, you know. And I have to say that very often people turn to me and say, you know, the River Cafe, all the food before the River Cafe was terrible, and we changed it, and we did. And I think there were a lot of us who did change it. But I also have a lot of respect for a country that was coming out of the war, you know, that had no food, that had rationing, that had to cook with what was available, but didn't have a kind of incredible choice that we have now. And so she was that kind of cook, and she taught me. She really taught me very northern, although she came from Florence. She taught me very much more northern. She came from Trieste as well, northern cooking. And then we moved to Paris, and I lived above a market, and I learned about seasonality, about going down to the market and saying, "But there was white asparagus yesterday, where is it?" And they said, "It's gone, but there are melons next week." You know, that idea that you say goodbye to a vegetable or a fruit, and then you say hello to another one. So I think it's been an evolution of cooking and eating and eating and cooking that really. And then when I met Rose, there were, you know, as I said, she'd lived in Italy. I'd known her a bit before. We came from very different backgrounds, but there was I always say that it was a great partnership because we loved the same kind of food. We knew that we only wanted to cook Italian food. We loved to eat Greek and Indian and Chinese, but it was Italy. And we voted the same way. Our politics were the same. You know, we raised our children really in the same way. And so starting a restaurant together was something that was very natural.
And did knowing artists, being around artists, have been... because it's certainly on me. I mean, being around artists who were paying attention in a way that not just to food, but to everything.
Yeah.
You know, who would like walk down a street, I'd be in Europe and, you know, they'd be looking at doorknobs.
Yeah.
And suddenly that attention got focused on food.
Yeah.
In this same way. I mean, for me, that was also really a change. You know, to suddenly be around people who
thought that everything that you did was important and what I could do was cook, and suddenly each ingredient became more important to me. I mean, it seemed, because you've been, you know, obviously Richard is an architect and you've had all these artists do wonderful drawings at the River Cafe. Yeah.
Rose taught art. She was an artist, and she there's some very beautiful drawings that she did in the book. I was a graphic designer, and I think being an architect and having friends, and the visual quality of food is, as you say, really important. You know, how we plate food in the restaurant, how we make the restaurant bright colors, and how we use, and in a way, in this book with the artist menus, we went to artists who we were involved with. So there's a mutual friend of ours, Elsworth Kelly, when he ate in the restaurant, drew on a menu. He went into the bathroom and took the menu and did a self-portrait on the back of a menu. And Cy Twombly was home for lunch, and we asked them. So we had these menus that I had, you know, of Cy's and Ellsworth's. And then we have upstairs, Damien Hirst has a studio right above now, the River Cafe, and various other artists. So we just asked them to be involved, because somehow a cookbook, giving the cookbook another dimension, you know. What do you think about visualness and art in the River Cafe? Because plating food is so visual, isn't it?
Plating, yeah. Because our food is very simple as well. It looks on the plate, you know, not too many ingredients, and actually the simplicity of that, you know, the plate has to be a beautiful white, you know, clean plate. You know, I'm kind of very, you know, particular about the way I see food on the plate, and sometimes I'll plate a dish and show the guys how you want it to be, and then they'll do what they think is the same, and in their eyes it is the same, but somehow it hasn't got quite that, you know. If you're just going to put a piece of mozzarella on a plate with some zucchini and a bruschetta, once you move that on the plate, there's a way that we learn to do it, and we have a very strong River Cafe style, where, you know, you're not going to get, you know, in trouble, but there is a house style that is very clean and beautifully plated with the most simple ingredients, but just it has a way that's very visual.
Can we talk for a minute about ingredients? And I mean, ingredients here have, in my lifetime, changed unbelievably. I mean, what you can get in New York now compared to, you know, when I wrote my first cookbook in 1972, my editor didn't even want me to use lamb because he said, you know, most Americans can't get lamb. And, you know, I mean, I had a recipe for handmade pasta, which just seemed, you know, my editor wanted me to leave it out because, you know, who would do that?
So, yeah. Well, when we did the first book here, Rose and I, for Random House, the blue book, I remember Jason Edson telling us that there was a recipe checker who lived in a town in Maine, and every ingredient had to be available 50 miles away from her house.
In Maine?
Yeah. And it was really restricting that, you know, that there was that. But now, and it was the same thing in London, Rose and I literally used to be ingredients back from Italy.
Oh, you have to tell the pumpkin story.
Oh, the pumpkin story. Were you on that trip?
No.
I was on that trip. So we go, every year, the River Cafe, we take the only rule is you have to have worked in the River Cafe 2 years, but we take altogether about 25 people who work for us to Italy. And so we take all the chefs. Go in November, we go to taste the new oil, to choose the new olive oil, and then we take a group to Piedmont, or we take a city trip, so that everybody's kind of exposed to, because people are cooking Italian food, but some of them haven't been to Italy, and this is kind of diverging from your question, but they all then experience the very close relationship we have with the people that produce the wine, especially in Tuscany and Piedmont. And so we go on a trip and we taste the olive oil, we taste the wine, we eat, get on the bus, taste the olive oil, taste the wine, eat and eat and eat. And this goes on, and it's very hard work, I can tell you. But that goes on for about 3 or 4 days. And on one of the trips,
Rose was given an enormous pumpkin, because we really celebrate the pumpkin when it's in season with, you know, stuffed pasta or soup. And so she had this pumpkin that was given to her, and when she checked in British Airways, they wouldn't let her on the plane with the pumpkin, and the only seat available was a business class, club class seat. So we always say, we went economy and the pumpkin went club. So, you know, that's the story. So
I love the image of this pumpkin sitting
with its seatbelt on. Yeah, exactly.
So I assume when you opened, you were using a lot of ingredients that came from Italy.
Yeah.
Are you still doing that?
Yeah. I'd like to say that nothing is actually comes by airplane to the River Cafe, except for the mozzarella, which is flown in from Naples twice a week. Because all our fish and all our meat is sourced within the waters of Great Britain and the farms in England, Scotland, Wales. But if we were to depend on the British agricultural market for our vegetables, it would be very, very difficult. It's changing. We have brought seeds back for certain Cavallonero. We have Agretti, we haven't conquered yet. And also I think British farmers are becoming, we have small market gardeners, we have gardeners who are in their kitchen gardens growing vegetables. We have people come to the door and say, I have some porcini that I picked in Richmond Park. But to sustain a restaurant that feeds, you know, 300 people a day, we can't depend on that. So we have two suppliers that, or even more, that go to the Milan market and bring back the Agretti, the Romana artichokes, you know.
Is Brexit going to have an effect on the restaurant?
We're terrified of Brexit, yeah. It's a real worry. I think it'll be probably, we don't know yet. I mean, the main problem, you don't want to get me started on Brexit.
Okay, I don't. So we only have about 2 minutes left.
Okay, go on. Yes.
So I want to ask you, what's it like to be an American living in England at this particular moment in American history?
Oh, well, I can answer that because very often people come up to me and they say, especially my American friends, you are so lucky, and aren't you happy to be away from the United States this time? And my answer is that after 40 years in Britain, I've never wanted to be here more, because I feel the only thing that we all have to do is be active. The only thing we can do to keep these values that we cherish is to be... engaged and involved, and I love that, you know, website, Run For It. You know, you're all very young, and you're women, you should be running for town councillor and school board, and, you know, whatever you're doing. I think that, so I'm trying to do it in my own little way. We have dinners, we have meetings, Democrats abroad, and I'm going to come back for the midterms and knock on every door I can. Thank you. I think we should have, we've been talking about us, but I think when I got the message from Becca that we were going to be, and from everyone here, that we were going to be sitting down with Ruth Reichel, it just was so exciting, because I know her work, I've read her books, Gourmet started, you know, all of us on an incredible trajectory of food. And, you know, she's an incredible woman, and I feel so privileged to be here with her.
That's it for today's show. It's always fun to dip into the archives. And what a moment. Two Ruths under one roof. Say that 3 times fast. Thanks to all of you who attended, spoke, and volunteered at Jubilee 2018. It was such a special day. Also, thank you to today's sponsors, Traeger Grills and Le Cordon Bleu Culinary School. Don't forget, we'd love if you could support the Hunger Doesn't Take a Break initiative from the Food Bank for New York City. Visit foodbanknyc.org for more. Radio Cherry Bomb is a production of Cherry Bomb Media. Our show is edited, engineered, and produced by Jess Seidman. Our special projects director is Lauren Page Goldstein. Our publisher is Kate Miller Spencer. And our intern is Julia Fabricant. Our theme song is All Fired Up by the band Cha La La. Thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.
I'll have what she's having.
Hey everyone, my name's Samantha Parquette. I'm a food and lifestyle photographer, and I'm currently on tour with Outstanding in the Field. Do you want to know who I think is the bomb? Alina Jaskowiak. She's my longtime friend and owner of Pine Food Company with her husband and business partner, Jerry Jaskowiak. Together, they nourish and teach the community the importance of eating and supporting local, and their Scratch Kitchen collaborates with local farms to support their seasonal menu. I am constantly inspired by the both of them and what they have achieved at such a young age, and they play a huge role in why I'm working in the food industry today.